Hey there. In this episode of Sample Space, we're going to be talking about SQLite Vec, which is a plugin for SQLite that allows you to do nearest neighbor kinds of queries on vectors. There's a bunch of databases that allow for this. There's a small ocean of VCs pouring money into this field. But what's really neat is that you can also do this from good old SQLite now. In this episode, I'm going to be talking to Alex Garcia to talk about all the events that led to him build this. And it involves some humble beginnings, as well as the field of data journalism. It's a very interesting talk, and it's a very exciting project. And I very much hope you'll enjoy this episode. Hi, Alex. Nice to have you on.
Nice to be here, for sure.
Super cool. So to get this conversation started, let me start off by saying I am a SQLite fanboy. Like, I've used it in a bunch of projects, and we're going to talk about some of the additions to SQLite that you've made. But we also talked before, and we exchanged some anecdotes, and I would like to maybe share some of the origin stories of you. Like, it's kind of the Marvel Avengers origin story that's always good to add in the podcast. Like, how did you eventually get here? I think you started with computer science originally. Is that my impression?
Yes, back in college. Yeah.
And what college did you go to?
University of California, San Diego. So down in San Diego. So I've been a Southern Californian boy for the most of my life. But I think it mostly started with I was very bored in classes. Computer science is great, but got bored most of the time and liked to do these small little projects. Most of them were like data science, data journalism related. So like it was like, oh, let me make this cool. The way I got into it was LA Times had this cool little graphic of every single shot that Kobe made. And I thought that was really cool. It had like purple dots for every single shot and if there are three pointers or not. And that excited me because I was like, oh, cool. They got the data set somewhere. They grabbed it somehow. And that's what got me into, D3 and data visualizations and building these stories or whatever. So with that, a lot of data wrangling is needed to create those stories because you want to output a nice little CSV that you eventually graph on D3 or on a map or whatever. So I think with those data loading scripts and everything, I eventually fell into SQLite and, I could use SQLite to store this data and write SQL queries to make a report or export a CSV or whatever to eventually go into these data visualizations. So that's how I stumbled into it.
When was this? Like around what time did you explore this?
So I started getting into like D3 and all that in 2017 when I was in college. I graduated 2019. So that's when I was like playing around with D3 and SQLite and all that.
Okay. This is making me feel a bit older because I remember doing the same thing in college. Like when I first saw D3, I was gobsmacked. Oh my God, visualizations can be so cool. It's just that when I saw it in college, it literally just came out.
Gen Z software engineers, man, they're here.
I think
at the time when I first looked into D3, there was like a big fight from, I think, D3 version 3 versus version 4. That's where they changed the JavaScript API quite a lot instead of nested objects to something else. So I remember that was like the first online open source fight that I saw. I was like people really care about like this JavaScript API, but yeah.
I remember, I think it was called InfoViz or something like that. And then this was part of Mike Bostock's PhD. Mike Bostock is the person who made D3 to the listeners. But I'm curious, were you into basketball? And was that kind of the reason that got you hooked into this data journalism thing? Or was it more about the storytelling that eventually drew you in? Because I seem to hear some sort of an emotional connection here as well.
To be honest, not really. I'm not like a big basketball guy. I like Lakers and all that from Los Angeles. So that's always a big thing. But I never really followed season by season or play by play or whatever. The fact that was the thing that piqued my interest, I'm not too sure why. I think it's because at the time it was like, I think I saw it from like a Data is Beautiful subreddit where there would be all those cool little visualizations all the time. And I think with that one in particular, I just liked how like easily accessible I think it was because there was a GitHub repository. I think that's around the time where I learned what GitHub was and like how programming and open source was. So I think that was the reason why it caught my attention. Mm-hmm. And of course, like times I grew up with them and fact that there was a data reporter there, I thought, oh, that's interesting as well. So I think it was more of a conversion of those things of learning about, oh, there are these newsrooms out there that do open source, that open source their work, but like, visualizations that look really cool and easy because looking at the code, like it was, I didn't understand most of the code, but I was like, oh, but if they could figure this out, then, maybe it's not too hard for me to figure it out. Maybe I can go and learn how this, how D3 or all this other Python Jupyter Notebook stuff works.
Yeah, okay. So it's basically, it got sparked by curiosity, and then from there, you just chased it, basically.
Definitely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is a nice place to get started. But then, you do your computer science stuff. You suddenly become aware of this thing called D3, and ball starts rolling there. So you were in college, you were playing around and you were exploring things. Was that easy for you? I can imagine you got to learn new tools and stuff like D3 typically is not taught in the computer science classes. So like when you think back of your college days, like what was the easy bit or hard bit when you're trying to learn these new things? I wonder.
Yeah, I think in college it was at first a lot of Java, C, C++, all that stuff just to learn like algorithms and such. I think I learned Python on my own just for kind of fun and it was just easy to pick up and Jupyter Notebooks was great. I think one trouble I ran up against that kind of helps, that kind of points to why I do SQLite Vec and some of the other things. I was running on a Chromebook for a long time while I was in university. I came in with a laptop that I had from high school, but it was like the hinges were broken. It was very heavy. I didn't want to take it to class. And I found out that Chromebooks are like fairly cheap on Amazon. That's what I usually did use for most of my classes. And most of my classes are like Google Docs or whatever. But a lot of like computer science classes are, they require like some form of like programming, some like IDE or something to use. And thankfully, most of our class assignments were like you SSH into a university server and do some like C programming stuff on the command line. Yeah. What I liked about having a Chromebook was that you could actually, at the time, I think you could still do it now, there is like an official Linux system that you could install on Chromebooks. So that gives you access to the command line and you can install some Linux apps and some Linux. You just have a Linux programming environment with a Chromebook. It wasn't that great because the Chromebook I had was like probably $200. It probably had 2 gigabytes of RAM, so you can't really run VS Code or anything. But that really forced me to learn about like different, one, when I was learning programming and like Python, Node.js and all this stuff, keeping like things small and not like installing these like giant dependencies, or I would never be able to run PyTorch or some of those other like crazy C++ dependencies projects out there. But I could very easily run a little Python script, or I can use observable notebooks because it was all in the web browser. And that was something that I really loved and I worked on for like years for quite some time. So I think that kind of working on a Chromebook really helped me like realize, oh, maybe I don't need to, or maybe I could work around not needing all this crazy programming stuff because I have such a small computer and not a lot of RAM and definitely not a lot of disk space. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that definitely helped me later on when I was building these open source projects like SQLite Vec and stuff where dependencies really matter.
That makes sense. I'm curious on your opinion on this one. One thing that has dawned on me is you do see a lot of these developers with big, shiny, new M4, whatever, MacBook Pros, like the super beefy laptops, if you think about it. These things are way heavier than the server somewhere. But if we want our software to be lightweight, shouldn't developers just have like really bad old laptops like as a forcing function to make sure that stuff still remains lightweight? I can imagine like having a Chromebook and actually forcing yourself to make things work. That is a great forcing function to learn how to keep things lightweight.
Definitely. Yeah. And it keeps like different technologies in check too. Oh, I can't use pandas because this is going to load everything into memory. Mm. Or, oh, this, maybe it's like this requires like Java dependencies that don't do too much. And I think, like in the days where most software engineers, at least the ones that work in open source and do all this stuff, have these like giant MacBooks or they throw everything into a Docker container or doing all that stuff. I think for a time, just came up talking about Docker. I think for a time I was also on that Docker train because I was like, oh, reproducible builds. You can have the entire OS in one little image.
Everything's immutable.
This is great. It's amazing. But then like now I uninstalled Docker desktop for the first time on my computer recently, just because right now I have like a 2019 MacBook, which is new, but not new for everyone, right? Because it's not even M1. It's still on the Intel chips and all that, but it's 250 gigabytes of space. I don't have a lot of space. Docker was taking up everything for me. I haven't used it in a while, so I just removed it. But I think I much prefer things that are like much, you just pip install or npm install and then you're good to go. And I think a lot of tools like UV and all that make that easier. But I think that was a big shift from in the past where I put everything into Docker because I was renting a EC2 instance that I can go in and run a big Docker image if I really wanted to, or fly.io or these other services that like you provide as a Docker file and then you're good to go and run. But nowadays I'm just like, I don't really need all that. It's a little bit easier if I could just run it all myself locally without needing Docker, without needing a Docker compose with 4 different services or whatever. And again, I think part of that is because back when I was working on a Chromebook and learning all these tools, Docker definitely didn't work, definitely couldn't do any containers or anything on there. But yeah, I think making things easier to run, making it easier for other developers to run, whether they're working on an old Windows machine or an old MacBook or whatever, makes it a lot easier. I'm sure it doesn't make sense for all software engineering projects, because I think if it's like a Rust project where you need all those giant resources to compile, because the compiler is such a big part of it, but it outputs a small little executable that doesn't use a lot of memory and stuff, that could really be useful for a lot of smaller machines or smaller computers. But it definitely depends on what you do and all. But for the most part, like less dependencies are better and easier to install stuff is better software most of the time.
Yeah. And once again, that's the cool thing with SQLite. It basically just comes with Python. If you can run a Python thing somewhere, it comes with SQLite. Basically, it can be part of your project. And also always, you start a new Django project or a Flask project on your machine and it just works because there's SQLite. And then you go, oh, I want to do production now. And then, do I need Postgres? Maybe. Okay, we'll set that up. And it's always this extra step that kind of breaks the flow in a way. So to me, like part of the joy of SQLite is it keeps things nice and lightweight. But there's also something to be said. It also keeps things simple. And that's also the magic of it.
Yeah, I probably use SQLite just because I couldn't install Postgres a few times. Because I'm sure like for some of those projects that I would do, I'd get like 2 weeks and be very excited on something like, oh, scraping TikTok videos or scraping whatever and be like a little data project that I have. And I'd be like, oh, maybe this time I'll try using Postgres because SQLite's too small. It's too slow or whatever. So now I'll try and install Postgres. I'm like, oh my God, like this is not fun and this is really annoying. This is much easier just to throw into a SQLite database just because it's already there. I don't have to install anything. And sure, it might be slower, but like most of the time it's a skill issue and I just did SQL wrong. Or like I can wait a couple seconds for something to happen. I don't really need that immediate back and forth. But again, that's because it's a small little data analysis project and not like a giant big web app that's making millions of dollars. There's that trade-off there. But bro, like most of the time, like SQLite's probably good enough.
Yeah, it's one of those interesting moments where I actually like Postgres. If I can pick a database, I don't think Postgres is a bad choice. It's just that because of SQLite, I also like it when I don't have to use it.
That's an interesting thing.
Yeah. That feels very liberating. I got to ask, what are some of your favorite features of SQLite? Like we talked about the benefit of it just works locally, but I can also imagine there are a bunch of these use cases out there. Like you can use it to store data and you can do your group buys and all that. But I'm curious, do you have any, is it something you use for data scraping as well? Is it like your default thing to write data into? Is that like a use case for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think at first when I was doing all these projects and stuff in college and after college, I would default to a makefile that would be all these random scripts that create CSVs and JSON files and all that. So it'd be like, oh, let me download this zip file from an FTP server from some government website. Mm-hmm. And then it's a zip file. So then I have to unzip it using another makefile target. And then unzips to a directory. And then I have another script that like reads all those files into a CSV file. And then another script that takes that CSV file and does like some analysis and outputs a JSON file. It was all these like different files and whatever.
Small data pipelines.
Yeah, exactly. But I realized like this would be much easier in a single SQLite table where I just get all the individual rows that I can from this like one data set, have one script that loads into a SQLite database. And then from there, I could do my filters, I could do my aggregates, my joins, whatever, without having to create like these intermediate files, these intermediate CSVs. In which case they're intermediate tables, which are much easier to kind of reason about and write SQL for and do analysis of and everything else. So I think that's what really got me onto like the SQLite train and how, for at least like these one-off projects, how that approach is probably better than working with individual files and a bunch of different scripts. I think there's a lot of properties of SQLite that are always great and that everyone always talks about, how, oh, a SQLite database is a single file, right? Or the actual like installing SQLite, it's literally just a single C file. So you could probably compile it yourself, or it's already installed in Python, or it's a NPM install away or PHP or whatever. Like it's very easy to install and run SQLite. It's also in the same thread. So you don't have to worry about like setting up a server or configurations or opening ports or whatever else. There's a lot of properties of SQLite that make that a little bit easier and that people really like. But I think for me, like the SQL aspect of it's mostly compliant with other SQLite. Especially like working with pandas and all that, it's a different API. And at least in a lot of these like data journalism projects and data journalism specifically, and also just the world, like not just like big tech companies, but a lot of people write a lot of different programming languages. It's not just like, if you work in a big tech company, maybe you're like, everyone uses Python, right? Because that's just who you are. And that's just like what you do. And you have practices and all that. You might have a case where like in a data journalism team, like a newsroom, some people write Python, some people write R, some people do like JavaScript in the browser only. And there's not a lot of technologies.
And who's this guy who does Java and talks about Maven? Huh? There's another tool?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But one nice thing is that SQLite could be like an easy connection to everything because they could all those programming languages, they have bindings to SQLite. They've been available for years because SQLite's been around forever. You talk to each other with SQL. You don't have to worry about like different APIs. That's one slightly annoying thing that I find about other database providers. You always have to have a client library for your programming language, right? Go bindings or Java bindings or whatever. And one, those bindings are always very hard. But two, they all have different features. Oh, the database that was written in Python, of course, their Python bindings are great, but their Node.js bindings, probably not going to be that great. It's probably not going to be like full feature parity and all that. Whereas the case where if you're using SQLite and using SQL as like the lingua franca, it's all the same SQL most of the time. Like it's all same thing, same easy way to do about it. It already integrates well with the specific programming language that you're in. So in Python, you have a built-in thing and it will give out like iterators, an iterator of rows you can go over, and JavaScript uses their iterator of rows. So it's a very it's a very easy thing to share among like teams that have different tools or different programming languages that they work with.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You can imagine this Frankenstein of a data project where, oh, we've got some scripts in R and some things in JavaScript and some things in Python. And then we pipe this thing into that thing via makefile and let's go. But if you can stick all of it to SQL, I still think I like some of the data frame APIs. Spoilers in particular is something I'm a huge fan of. It allows me to write from top to bottom, left to right. And especially when you do joins inside a SQL, the SQL thing can get nested. I do think that's a downside. But the main benefit you do gain is it is just like a simple SQL dialect. If you want to get fancy, there's plugins, but it is a very default SQL dialect. There's not really anything super fancy happening in there.
Yeah. And a lot of these data frame libraries can just call SQLite directly. It'll just generate SQL for you under the hood and run things. So that exists in basically all big data frame libraries that I know of. So that's always good. I think also another feature of SQLite that I forgot to mention before, extensions, of course. That's one thing that I really like about it. I never really got into like low-level stuff until I got into SQLite extensions, because that requires like C, FFI, foreign function interfacing and all that. But I think that's really unlocked a lot of features for me for these projects to do like a lot of, like an easier way to parse URLs or parse file paths or read CSVs and all that. SQLite has a very extensive extension API that, and a ton of really good documentation on how you can build tools that do that. So that's been, of course, one thing that I've worked a lot with SQLite back in.
And this is like a little ecosystem at this point as well, right? Like, I'm sure there's someone who did something with geodata, and I'm sure there's someone else who did something with images. And it's like Python has all these pip installable packages. I don't think it's called pip in SQLite land, but there's extensions, I think they call it. Or is it plugins?
Yeah. Anton, I forget his last name, but he is the creator of SQL Lean, and he has another project called SQL Package. That's a command line interface that he has a registry that he manages with a lot of like open source SQLite extensions that are out there. So you could do like SQL package install whatever, and there's a configuration file that you could use to keep SQLite extensions in check.
Like a requirements.txt kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, just like that. There's also, I also tried making one. I just haven't published it yet because it was like half completed, called like SQLite package manager. That was also very similar. So you could have a requirements.txt like file and install and upgrade and things like that. I think most of the time, the approach that I take, and I could talk about SQLite extension distribution for days, but I publish my SQLite extensions on pip and npm and gem and cargo and go modules and all that. Basically, like every package manager that I could find that could like that makes sense to include as a SQLite extension. I find using those package managers are much easier for teams than like having to invent a new package manager to use. Because if you are using Python, then just throw SQLite back into your requirements.txt and then it all works, right? Or same thing with npm or Python or whatever. It all has the same version, so if you want a version across multiple projects together, you can do that as well. So there's a lot of different approaches on like how SQLite extension management is, but
it's a good investment in developer experience, I would say. You're basically just, you don't have to learn a new language or a new tool, you can just still readily install it. One thing I do want to do though, because what we're doing right now, rightfully, is we're establishing good reasons to SQLite, which is great. But I'm still curious like how you got here, because at the moment you've graduated, you've been interested in, okay, some of this data stuff, D3 stuff, need to teach myself data things, and SQLite's a nice candidate because of my Chromebook and other reasons. But it's still, you didn't make SQLite VEC right out of college, right? I'm assuming there's something that happened between there.
Yeah, so I graduated in 2019, and then I immediately started working at Facebook in 2020, March of 2020, which is a great time to start anything new in your life around that time. Something happened around that time. So working from home, I was living with my parents at the time. I was going to move out in like March of 2020 to start my new job. Then I was like, okay, this is great. Let me just stay here for a while, because everything was remote for a while. So I was working at Facebook Oculus on the headsets. I was specifically working on search inside the headset. So when you put on the headset and you want to search for a specific game or title or whatever, there's a little search bar, and now there's a voice icon, little thing that you can click and speak to it or whatever. Okay. So that was like my full-time job for right out of college.
So from D3, you're doing VR stuff, to put it.
Yeah, completely different. Yeah. Okay. I didn't enjoy it too much. Part of it, Facebook is Facebook. And also the stuff that I was working on and the team I was on was understaffed, and COVID was going on. A lot of things weren't that great. But at the same time, I was still working on these projects. I was like, let me try the SQLite thing or this little make file to download whatever, everything. So I was still active in that like open source thing. But like my full-time job was Facebook at the time.
But was this also maybe a moment of like recognition for you that, I seem to be working on VR stuff that's supposed to feel very cool, but I still feel drawn to this data nerdy thing that I actually seem to like more? Was that also what was 100%. Happening in your mind at that time?
Yeah. I think like at the time I was like, I've just been doing all this data SQLite stuff on the side ever since college, just because I was bored. Maybe when I have a full-time job and I'm actually working as a software engineer, then I'll like shake all this stuff off and learn some other stuff. But that didn't happen. I was like, this stuff is cool. This VR stuff is cool. But I'm not really enjoying it. This SQLite stuff is a lot of fun. These open source tools are really cool. Maybe I could do something in there. I was only at Facebook for about a little less than a year, and I left and started consulting after that. So I started doing self-employed freelance stuff from then on out.
Because from a distance, at least, it does feel like it does take a little bit of courage, right? Because you're just fresh out of college. On paper, you're supposed to be working at a FANG. Like, you did it, right? Like, on paper, in theory, you should stay. I can imagine as a feeling. But what, do you remember what was like the tipping point for you that made you like, here's the line, I'm going to really just go for this? Because again, like on paper, a lot of parents and a lot of people would probably advise you, oh, you're at Facebook, stay. Yeah. Like, it's a good employer.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I would have really, I knew that I would enjoy working on this other stuff, whether it's like data analysis projects, data engineering, SQLite stuff. And I knew I wasn't getting that from working at Facebook. I had a few possible, and a few like leads of like what I could do for freelancing stuff here and there. So like small things here and there. I think in the journalism space, like it's very common to do like freelance stuff. And there are some freelance data journalists, but it's not very common. So it was, and I think at the time I was with my parents, living with my parents, it was still COVID. I had a lot of money from working at Facebook for even if it was a short amount of time. I had like a cushion to work off of just in case like things would go
so
kind of haywire.
It wasn't like a huge leap in the unknown. You had a bit
Like I didn't have kids. I didn't have, I was very safe to do that.
But well done. Because not everyone does that. And not everyone has the privilege to do that. But if you recognize you got the privilege, it is cool to just chase your dream. It's a very American thing to say, maybe, but not everyone does that. So well done.
Yeah. And I would be much richer if I stayed in Fang and working on that stuff until then, but at least I'm working on cool stuff.
That, definitely well done there. But okay. So you did the VR thing, then you started doing freelance work. And I guess, what can you, if it's NDA, don't say, but what kind of freelance work would this be? Would that be like, hey, there's the New York Times or something like that, and they just need some extra hands to help out with this visual, or there's need to scrape websites, or what kind of work would you then do?
Yeah, it wasn't a lot of newsrooms themselves. It was a lot of like adjacent data visualization. I like to call them like data visualization boutiques, where these organizations will go up to these agencies and they'd be like, oh, we want this really cool website for this data set that we're publishing, right? We want to have visuals. We want to have a way that people can export it or play around with it or whatever, that kind of stuff.
Would that be these websites where there's like this infinite scroll thing and every time you scroll deeper, there's like a better chart, like this kind of, these kinds of sites?
That kind of stuff. Yeah. I think the biggest thing that's public I could talk about, populationexplorer.org. So at the time I was working with Stamen doing a lot of freelance stuff. They had a project through Meta, actually Facebook, actually. So the Facebook Data for Good team, they had a data set that they had curated that was like, they figured out a way to do population estimates, high resolution population estimates, like for every 30 square meter, something like that, like a global data set, right? So you want a website where it was a map that you can go and explore and you can like highlight certain places or search for a country and see like a population, high resolution population map of that place. You could also have a lasso tool and draw a specific place and get an estimate of how many people probably live in that space. I think it's more so for help in other countries where census aren't taken at a regular cadence, or the data themselves isn't that good of like how many people live in a certain area, especially in rural areas or places that are way out there. And they had their own like PhDs and researchers doing stuff like, oh, satellite imagery and machine learning and all that. But they had like this data set that they wanted to visualize. So I work with Stamen, which is one of these, basically a data visualization boutique that focuses a lot on like cartography and mapping. So that was like an example project that I would work on.
Didn't the Stamen people also contribute this very well-known black and white like mapping layer?
Yes.
That's them, right?
Yeah. So they're very well-known like in the cartography space and all that. But that was an example of projects that I would do up until recently of, oh, like D3, JavaScript, you could do some like data loading, data engineering tasks. Let's have you on to build this little website for a client to popularize their data set or whatever.
And if you were to reflect, like there can be many reasons why this is enjoyable. One thing I would imagine is that this also exposes you to just interesting data sets that are just different every month or so. Like that I can imagine that's like a part of it.
Definitely.
Is it also maybe the journalism thing that you're also working on explaining these important data sets that could also be used for greater good? Is it also part of the motivation?
Yeah, it wasn't like most of the projects that I did were not this altruistic or not this cool. A lot of them were like, oh, eventually we want this data set to be shown to journalists. That way they can use it in their own reporting for whatever. But I think that was more so for, oh, we just want more people to see it. I think that's definitely a part of, but I guess another thing to explain, I'm not a data journalist. I've never worked in a newsroom before. But I do like that space, and I've gone to data journalism conference quite often in the past several years, actually, now that I think about it. A lot of it's some of these technologies that I work with are stuff that like data journalists can take advantage of. So like observable notebooks, I was like really into those for like many years, and I would go to some data journalism conference and teach classes about it, or showing people like, oh yeah, instead of having to set up a...
You keep revolving around the data journalism thing and the journalism stuff, but isn't that part of you was just so interested in journalism that part of the motivation was, oh, I like journalism. Maybe my role in the ecosystem is just to work on the tools for data journalists. Was that kind of the motivation then?
I think it's where I found myself
Right. Being, okay.
I'm like building these tools for data journalists. That's something like I have a big background now in like open source and software engineering and all. That's one place I see myself where I can do a lot of impact in this space. I think working as a journalist itself has a lot of skills that I just don't have, whether it's like writing stories or talking to sources and all that.
Yeah.
That's something that I probably could have learned.
It's way more storytelling if you're doing that, but storytellers also need tools. Like, and that's like an interesting insight.
Yeah. And basically now I think about it, everything I do now is maybe not specifically for a data journalist, but could be helpful for data journalists. So like what we're doing a data set with Simon Wilson and all that, a lot of that's like geared towards or for data journalists, or these SQLite extensions and all that can be run by data journalists and all. So that is like something that I just find myself. I think another interesting thing about is like data journalists themselves, it's a very niche thing. Not a lot of people are in the space. It's unfortunately news industry itself is dying in some terms. There's a lot of less funding for it. But the people who do this work of data journalism, who write code and do all this stuff, they're fairly similar to a lot of other, their needs and what they do is very similar to a lot of other industries or companies that are out there. There's a lot of companies out there that aren't big tech, that aren't the Facebook or Metas out there, but have people that kind of code or do a lot of like other stuff, or they have a small little Python team and they're not like full-on software engineers. So maybe they don't do version control, maybe they don't do all that, but they still need someone to go into an Excel workbook and crunch all these numbers and all that. So I think one thing that we learned, like especially working on data set, is that if we build tools for data journalists, a lot of other people can benefit. Oh, you make this tool like easier to run for data journalists. You also made it easier to run for like software engineers that are out there, or for other people who do coding as a small part of like their entire job role. It could also be helpful for them. So that's one thing that we noticed for data set specifically, that building these tools for journalists like benefit everyone. If that makes sense.
This might be a good place and time to also maybe explain two things. Because one, you and I both know Simon Willison and the Dataset Project, but I can imagine not everyone who's listening might. And it might also be interesting, like, how did you meet Simon? Like, I'm assuming Dataset existed before you met him, but like maybe that part of the story. Because, how do you meet him?
Yes, Simon Willison is a prolific open source developer, blogger, who recently talks a lot about artificial intelligence and data work and data journalism and such. He's had a long, prolific past in blogging for as long as I've been alive. And honestly, and a lot of open source projects that are very beneficial, co-created Django many years ago. So definitely has like a very history past. He has an open source project called Dataset that was created maybe 7-8 years ago, I believe.
I want to say 5, but probably longer, yeah.
Yeah, it is Dataset itself is an open source project where it's a tool that you point to a SQLite database and it will give you a nice web UI to explore that data. You can view all the tables, go through all the rows, filter through stuff, write SQL in it, all in this little web interface. The idea is that you can use that to publish data for everyone, right? So you could be like a government agency that has a data set of whatever and you want everyone to see it. So you put all that data inside of a SQLite database, you point data set at it, and then everyone can access it around the world. And they can do their own filtering, faceting, SQL queries, all that such. It's a tool that does that, specifically for SQLite databases and for the benefit of open data and all that stuff.
And so, to the people listening, it is a really cool tool. I do like really recommend people check it out. It has a nice UI. And the interesting thing with that UI is when you use it, it actually generates SQLite that becomes part of the query string. So anything you can write in SQLite also becomes an API. And that's the magic of it. Like, it's not just for data journalism. I have found it to be incredibly productive for rapid prototyping anything. Like, it's basically your demo API that's just given, and you will always have a UI of the actual data attached to it as well. So if you're a developer, you might also just want to check it out. It's the one extra claim I want to make to that project.
Yeah, the JSON API is probably the coolest thing. Yeah. You just pass in an SQL as an SQL query string, and then it returns JSON data of whatever you have. And you can have parameters that do like extra filtering or other logic in there. So it's quite and it's all out of the box. You don't have to configure it out outside of that. So that's a lot of really cool things in Dataset. So Simon Willison has been a part of the data journalism sphere for quite some time. He worked at The Guardian a number of years ago, and he did some other projects that are in the data journalism world. So he would also go to these conferences. The conference itself is called NICAR. It's the National Institute of Computer Assisted Reporting. It's a yearly conference. It's been going on for 60 years, which is quite insane. But it's usually journalists who work at these newsrooms who want to learn more about, sometimes it's like Excel work, right? Or it could be like, I want to learn about R or Python or building JavaScript D3 data visualizations or maps for my projects and such. So it's quite a mixture of a group of people and a mixture of like experience levels as well. So they have classes and workshops and everything that you expect out of a conference. But Simon Willison will also go to these conferences and I would attend some of his classes and such. I think we met each other, even though we would go to these conferences, We met each other through Twitter because I had a few open source projects related to observable notebooks, and Simon Wilson was a big fan of observable notebooks. So after a few projects of mine probably got retweeted into his timeline, we started following each other, and that's how we met.
One thing I wonder about those conferences. So at some point when I go to a Python conference, I do look around and I do go, I've seen that talk before. And there's always the talk on daytimes because daytimes. But I can imagine if you go to one of these conferences, it's definitely a little bit more of a wider net, right? Like, it's not just different technologies, but you also get the exposure of the end user and the journalists and stuff like that. Like, does this help make the conference so attractive to you? Like, I can imagine that's part of the appeal, but I'm just curious what drew you into this conference in the first place.
Yeah, I think most of the workshops themselves, they're fairly technical, but like, they're not too much of an interest to me. It's an intro to some R library for HTTP requests. I don't work with R. I could learn it if I wanted to, and I could just read the documentation because I'm used to that as a software engineer, like learning a new library and like working with code and all that. But a lot of these people who go to these conferences aren't, right? They could be students, or they could just be like early in their career, or they've never coded before. So having a class they can go to and learn about it is fairly good. So I think for them, it could be like part of their like education budget in their newsrooms for them to go to a conference like this and learn. What I really like is a lot of these workshops for this conference specifically are like data journalists just talking about the stories that they made and how they made it, where it's, we worked on this like story about housing and like finding out landlords in the San Francisco area. And we tried to figure out like all these like shadowy like LLCs and how they connect with each other. And we had to do like freedom of information requests to get information from the government. And this is the steps all we did, only to figure out this. And this is the story that we made. And we used this data set to do graphics of that. So there's a lot of like things like that as well, like actual like real world experience. I don't go there too much with the technical talks anymore, because like you said, a lot of them are like repeats of previous years or like fairly straightforward. It's something that you can learn yourself if you really wanted to. But there's a lot of like interesting talks like that, which are pretty cool. And also you can see people going to those talks and being like, I really wish we had a central place for us to, you know, store this data set amongst like other journalists and talk about it with each other and like figure out like different ways to query the data set and all that. Because we were just like emailing CSVs back and forth. And we're like, dataset would be great for you. Let's talk with you. It's like that. So.
Okay. So it makes sense. So, okay. That's how you find your way to this conference. And this is how Simon also finds his way to this conference. And then the two of you at some point, you have a coffee, I imagine.
Yeah. Yes. We talked at one of the conferences. And then, so the reason why I talk about Simon a lot right now and dataset is, so I currently, my current mostly full-time thing is I am a contractor for fly.io. Where my work is to help Simon build out Dataset Cloud. So Dataset Cloud is going to be like a SaaS version of the Dataset open source project. So it's a service you could sign up for or work with SQLite databases within our web interface and like work with coworkers and all that. And you can collaborate, comment on things, talk with each other, that kind of stuff, right? So it's like a paid version of the open source Dataset project. So Simon Willison has been building it for a number of years now. It is built on fly.io using their machines API, where you could spin up servers and tear them down quite easily and work with volumes and SQLite databases and everything. So he's been wanting to launch that for a while, but it's quite a lot of work to get something that actually works well and like works correctly. So currently fly.io is hiring me to help Simon build that out, because it's going to be one of those featured ways that you could use the fly.io APIs, right? Yeah. Like, Dataset Cloud is built on fly.io. This is how it works. That's currently like what I've been mostly working on for the past like several months. I work with Simon a lot, building Dataset Cloud and building out these features. Sometimes they're like dataset plugins that are like built for data journalists. Other times it's just like more infrastructure work to get it working. So that's like my main thing that I've been working with Simon for now. But yeah, I did meet him through a conference. And then a few weeks later, he's, hey, I talked to some fly.io. We could have the setup. Does that work for you? And then eventually it went through as a contract. And that's what I'm working on now. Yeah.
And do you still, because this is some of the stuff that you get paid for, but this would mainly be data set work, I imagine. But you also still write some software for journalists, is my impression, right? Is that also data set related, or is that separate?
Most of the time it's data set related, the journalism specific ones. I think I have a lot of other open source projects. Sometimes they're related to when I'm working with data set. Other times they're not really. I do 4 days out of the week working with fly.io and working with Simon on Dataset Cloud. And that other day and the weekends is mostly like the other open source projects that I have. So all the SQLite extensions, SQLite Vec, all that other stuff is mostly separate from fly.io. Sometimes there's some overlap. Oh, we want to build a semantic search engine using SQLite Vec with Dataset Cloud. Then there's some overlap there, and I can do some work here and there. But that's how my setup is. It's definitely a very weird setup. It's definitely the weirdest freelancing/contract work that I've had so far. I enjoy it a lot, and it's been very helpful.
Interesting. Okay, so Small tangent. Like, I want to get back to like more of the SQLite stuff, but because you also mentioned that you're working with Dataset and also for these journalists, you also make some software for these journalists. And I can also imagine that you're sometimes surprised of their needs. As you mentioned, you go to a conference, you learn about how they do their research and that kind of a thing. Like, what's your favorite anecdote from writing software for journalists? Because it's a very specific audience. You're definitely in a niche, but also an important one, and also one that has very specific non-standard needs, I reckon.
Yeah. Yeah, I think most of the time it's fairly similar to what people and other, like, other software engineers really care about. It's, oh, like, how do we keep track of data sets? How do we like work with, collaborate on this kind of stuff? So it's fairly, you hear very similar things to what you probably hear in a normal like data engineering conference, I think, to be honest. I think for data journalists though, like, it's all about budget and it's all about like headcount, right? I think one interesting thing is that a lot of data journalists, they're the sole person in the newsroom that does any data work, right? And these could be very well accomplished, very smart people who can do Python programming, do all that stuff. But a lot of their work is another reporter contacting them and being like, oh, someone sent me this Excel workbook. Can you figure out, can you help me like sum up all these numbers in these columns, right?
Yeah. Or, we have an analysis in a Jupyter notebook somewhere. Hey, can you run it? Kind of that kind
exactly,
of stuff.
Exactly, yeah. And they have to do so much in addition to, oh, can you make this chart that's going to be on our front page that's COVID cases in our county for the past year? Or, oh, can you like create a US elections map of our state to work with this? So it varies quite a lot. Sometimes there's enough people to handle it and they have a well-funded data desk or a lot of journalists working behind it, or they can hire out contractors to help them out with that kind of work. Or other times it's, oh, can you just do all this stuff for us and the pay is going to be not that great. It's a lot of things like that.
Yeah. Bootstrapping and all that. Okay, yeah. That makes sense.
But again, is very similar to a lot of other small startups out there, right? Where you only have one data engineer that built the entire data stack in one afternoon because that's the only time that they had. So it's very, I guess it's similar in that case, but also data journalists themselves do not get paid very well across the board. So that's another thing.
It's basically it's just another kind of journalism. So journalism doesn't really bring huge trucks of money in. Okay, so one thing I'm curious about, because it's a recurring theme sometimes. Okay, so you've got your data set stuff, you're working on that. And I can also imagine sometimes some of your open source work blends into that. But it also means that effectively you are paid to do some open source work. And it also means that in the weekends, you can really pick what open source work to really work on. So did that also cause a mental shift in you? Because I've heard that experience from some people where, oh, wait, I'm in the weekend now. That means that if I'm doing open source work, it really needs to be my thing as opposed to someone else's thing. That's like a mind shift that happened. Did you experience something like that?
I think so, yeah. I think I always have to be cognizant of what I'm working on at the time, just because contracting and like figuring out hours and all that. So I think most of the time, 4 days out of the week, it has to be about data set and about like building these plugins or working on data set cloud or things like that. And then when I usually on the fifth day, I work on SQLite Vec related stuff, right? Mm. And that's sponsored through Mozilla. I have like features and stuff that I want to build out through there. But then on the weekends, yeah, like there are a few projects that I have personally that like have that also really relate to SQLite, but like it's not about like Dataset Cloud or it's not about SQLite Vec. Maybe it's another type of extension or maybe it's something else. And that's usually what I work on the weekends. I think if I could choose, I would like to change this ratio of 4 days on Dataset, 1 day on SQLite Vec, half a day on other stuff. I'd like to change those ratios as I wish at certain. Oh, like there's a lot of stuff for SQLite Vec I want to get out. Maybe I can move things around or work on that more on the weekend. But then if I don't, then I can't work on this other smaller projects that I have. It is a little bit of a push and pull at times to figure out like
a week only has 7 days, and sometimes that's a bummer. That's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So one thing I wonder is because my impression is, okay, I do want to move to SQLite Vec now. So your background is clear. You met Simon. We're going to do journalism stuff. But at some point you reckoned, hey, you know what? I'm going to do this SQLite Vec thing. You've had a project before SQLite Vec that also explored this. But I think SQLite Vec is the name of the project people should take for serious now, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. How did that happen? Was it just a brain fart? You went, hey, I want this feature to be in SQLite Vec. Let's have a go at it. Or was there also like a cause for it or a need?
Yeah, so I think in general, I started working on like SQLite extensions like in the time where I started contracting and before I started working with Simon. So there was like some time where I was working on SQLite extensions for reading lines from a file, reading CSVs, regular expressions, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think right before I started working with Simon almost full time, maybe 6 months before, we were talking on Discord. There's a dataset Discord, which you should join if you're listening. But he mentioned, oh, hey, I didn't really know much about vector search. And that was like a really big thing at the time. And he was like, oh, hey, there's this C++ library from Facebook called FICE, or FACE, like Facebook AI similarity search, that does vector search. Can this be a SQLite extension? And I was like, I don't know what vector search is. Let me figure that out. And then after about a month or so, I figured out like what vector search was and semantic search and how that could work. And I figured out using that library, Feist, I built SQLite BSS, which is a vector search SQLite extension on top of Feist that was supposed to be vector search, right? That's what I had initially. Maybe this was like maybe in the beginning of 2020 or something, or 2023, the years get mixed up. And that was a cool approach. And I learned about like what vector search was, but it's horribly inefficient. I think Feist itself really, it demands that all your data can be stored in memory. It has a bunch of C++ dependencies that are very hard to work in other places. So I only really had it working in macOS and Linux, no Windows, no WebAssembly, no other platforms. It was just those two. So it was used up a lot of memory. It had a lot of really cool features, but you don't really need a lot of those features. So overall, like I wasn't satisfied with that SQLite extension. So I was like, okay, this vector search stuff that I initially thought was very hard and that I would need a C++ library for, I think I could do it all myself. It's all just cosine distance and managing some memory blobs here and there. I think I could just rewrite everything. And oh, I could only run on my on macOS and Linux. I wanted to run on my Chromebook and on my phone and WebAssembly and all that stuff. So I was like, I can rewrite all this from scratch using C. It will not be as fast. It will not be as cool, but it will be good enough and it could run everywhere. So that was like my ethos of building SQLite Vec. And this was during the time of, at this point, it was maybe 6 months to a year after SQLite BSS. I was already working with Simon. And I was like, I could work on this on the weekends. This will be a cool little SQLite extension. It'll be able to run everywhere on all operating systems, WebAssembly, Android, Raspberry Pis, all that stuff. So that's how I got into SQLite Vec specifically, but yeah.
I can imagine, and at that time, you were probably thinking of Alex back in college and wants to run this on a Chromebook as well. Like I seem to hear that motivation be a pretty big part of it.
Most of the issues that I see coming from open source are like, oh, I can't get this running on Windows. I'm always like, oh man, I want to get this running for you because I know that feeling of I can't run this on my Chromebook. What do I do? And a lot of times in open source, people tend to ignore it just because, oh, I don't have a Windows machine. I only have Mac, so I don't really know how to debug it. Exactly, yeah. Yes. So I spent so much time on all my extensions, debugging through GitHub Actions. Oh, how can I build this? How can I make it work? How can I test things? That's one thing that I care a lot about from that time of, oh, trying to install PyTorch on a Chromebook. Yeah.
So this is going to be an impossible question to properly answer, of course, but would this have happened? How much SQLite Vec would have happened if you had the privilege of having the newest MacBook when you were in college? And part of me does wonder, because I can really imagine part of the drive here is motivated because your own personal experience, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I might have just stuck it out with SQLite BSS to begin with. I think one interesting thing, about 2 days before I announced that I was working on SQLite Vec, Mozilla reached out, Mozilla AI people, and they're like, oh, we see SQLite BSS, the previous extension. We have a lot of experience. At the time, they had LlamaFile as like one of the projects that they were sponsoring, which if you don't know, LlamaFile is a project that you can turn an LLM into an executable file. So it's this giant file that you download. It works on all operating systems, Windows, macOS, everything. You can run it yourself and you can run things like Llama 3 or Llama 2 or Gemma and all those cool large language models from a single file, right? And that requires a lot of cross-compilation, making things work on different operating systems. So at the time, they reached out and they're like, oh, hey, we know SQLite BSS is hard to compile on different platforms. We know a lot of people that are working on this right now. We could probably get it to work and cross-compile everywhere. Is that something that you're interested in? And I was like, oh, good thing you reached out. I literally have this new project that's written in C that already does all that stuff, so we won't have to worry about it. I think if I did have a big, beefy MacBook all throughout college now, I would probably be like, hey, I could probably make SQLite BSS work. And if you're not using these cool new computers, you're screwed, right? Oh, go try something else, right? Use NumPy or whatever. So I think I think a lot of signs were pointing for me to try and make SQLite BSS work and just deal with the high memory and C++ dependencies. But I think I'm like, no, we can make it work on whatever. And I think part of it's also like SQLite philosophy too, right? Oh, small, works everywhere, doesn't use a lot of resources.
It's on so many embedded devices.
Yeah, like exactly.
It's on your iPhone, it's on your everything.
Yeah. And I think if I did have a big beefy MacBook in college, I probably could have figured out how to install Postgres and maybe not have used SQLite at all. So yeah. It was a good thing I had that little.
Yeah, it's always impossible to do the what ifs, but in this particular case, I do think it's interesting to at least point out that, hey, that constraint might have actually been a good thing in hindsight. We do have lighter software because of it. Yeah. So this can actually be motivation not to be that new MacBook if you're a developer. Just an interesting observation. But okay, like you're about to launch SQLite Vec then. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it got a fair amount of attention. There's been the SQLite Vec community. I think they're very eager for this. There's no shortage of VCs pouring money in like vector lookup database companies these days. So having something that at the core is like nice and lightweight and at least like always available, it felt like you really hit a nice nerve in terms of a need in the community in that sense. Was that also like the reception that you got for it?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and even when I was like building it, I was like, this hurts like a perfect spot that doesn't require a lot of extra dependencies, works across all languages and all that. There are a few other similar projects like USearch and a few other things that are like similar. But the fact that like it was built on SQLite and is very native to that was such a big pull. So I knew that, oh, this is going to be like a good spot for a lot of people. And yeah, when you announce it and write a blog post and on Twitter and Hacker News and all that stuff, like people always talk about it, which is great. I think this is the first time that when I had an open source project through Mozilla, so Mozilla's a sponsor of SQLiteVec, they gave me a Discord channel in the Mozilla AI Discord that has a significant audience. And that channel, I could get project updates and talk with people. And I also do online events there like every month where I like, it's, I don't want to say webinar because webinars have this like nasty term, but like every month I'll basically take a blog post and turn it into an hour long chat or like a presentation where I'm like, oh, for example, I just did one about hybrid search, right? You use SQLiteVec and SQLite full text search together for like hybrid semantic search and full text search, which is way better for most search engines, right? So that was a nice blog post. It was examples and code and all that. But I could also do a presentation where I can go deeper into it and be like the motivations behind it or like, oh, I tried this, but this didn't work. And it's like, I kind of view it as making these quote unquote online videos / webinars. They're like tech talks that for a conference that I can make up at any time, because I always want to give tech talks. Like tech talks are something that I love doing. I mean, creating these presentations, making it.
You get to brag about your own open source project. What's not the
like? Exactly. Yeah. But like a lot of these conferences out there are like what I do, but not really, or they're only happen every year or every other year, so it's hard to get a slot or whatever. But if you make your own videos, you could make your own tech talk and talk about whatever you want and have no constraints about whatever. So that's one reason why I come to
say. Are these videos up on YouTube, by the way, or something public?
Yes, they're an unlisted playlist. I'll probably make them public. But so if you go to...
We'll just add them to the show notes if people are interested. Because my first response was like, hey, I did not see these videos. I want to see them. But yeah, we'll add them to the show notes.
Yeah, I'm very awkward, by the way, in my videos. I don't know how to talk to people. I've gotten much better since the very first one. But yeah, they usually have a blog post that accompanies them that talks about more or less the same thing. But if you want to watch videos, I'll definitely
I can recommend the blog post, by the way, also because you have a nice layout on your blog. But the blog posts are definitely like a very clear explainer and like nice reads as well. But then, okay, we're at the spot where we can now do vector lookup stuff inside of SQLiteVec. And if I remember correctly, Mozilla is still sponsoring you for that work?
Yes, yeah.
The one thing I wonder, did you expect the amount of attention it got? Because it feels like it's a popular thing now. I could be mistaken. It's still early days, of course, right? But like people are playing with this as we speak. Did you expect the amount of attention that it got?
I think SQLite VSS, the previous vector search extension, did get a lot of like attention, a lot of people commenting on it. But it was the same, oh, like this looks cool, but I can't use this because of XYZ, whether that's like the dependencies or how it uses everything in memory or how it's like a little bit buggy. And I knew that creating this new SQLiteVec extension would basically solve all those problems and make it better in most cases.
Right. Yeah.
And I knew that the growth for SQLite VSS was stunted, so that way, and SQLiteVec would like just take all that and grow a little bit larger. So I knew that this has an audience and it will work a lot. I think one nice thing is that I did build from that extension and other extensions. I already built like an audience of like people who are interested in SQLite extensions or companies that could be sponsors of it. So for example, also Terso and SQLite Cloud and Flight.io are also sponsors of SQLiteVec. Because I have talked to them in the past, probably from SQLite VSS or other things. So I knew that, okay, I could probably get sponsors for this. So like I don't have to worry about spending too much time, but I can spend a little bit more time than I would like to make this a little bit nicer and easier to use and documentation and all that. So I knew that it would hit a good note based off of all that, but it's definitely a little bit more popular than I expected, which is great.
Yeah, and there's companies like Terso that try to be like a SaaS product around SQLite. So it's also in their interest that more cool stuff happens to SQLite, because then that product also becomes better. But one thing I also just want to observe is you're in an interesting, enviable position that you're not just... it's not like you're getting paid to do open source on one project. You're actually getting paid to do open source on two projects, which is also just rare.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're in an interesting phase for SQLiteVec. It's definitely not done yet. Like, I know that you're working on some features. If I remember correctly, it can definitely do the brute force lookup for similarity searches, but there's no indexes in there yet, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So there's definitely stuff you want to do. What's the future of SQLiteVec? Like, what makes you excited to build more features for it?
Yeah, so I think immediately I want to add metadata filtering and partitioning to SQLiteVec. Mm-hmm. So right now you store vectors in a VEC0 virtual table that has, it does a brute force comparison every time, right? This feature, first one would be partitioning. So you could add a partition key to that. So for example, instead of having one large index, one large vector index for all vectors for all users, you can instead partition it by user, right? So you could have a user ID that you add. So when you insert vectors, you also insert a user ID. And when you look up, you can do, oh, I only care about this user, and I'll only search their vectors. So if you don't have a million vectors, and search, instead of searching through all million of them, you can only search for the 5,000 that user ID 123 owns.
So if you want to use SQLite Vec for a recommender, let's say you would still want to do vector lookup, but someone could say, oh, but I'm only interested in science fiction, something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can like a predefined index of only given a certain key, whether that's a user ID or some other string or whatever. So that'd be like one, that's one approach to make things a little faster. Another would be metadata filters. So you can add other columns that are like metadata, age of a person or chapters or labels or dates or whatever else. So when you do filtering, you can filter on those metadata attributes instead. So we'll skip through the ones that aren't, that don't match those things. And I have plans for like rich metadata types, so Booleans and integers and strings and all that, using an arrow memory layout that's stored on disk. So for example, it's for strings, it would only store the first, I believe, first 12 characters, and then the rest in like other offsets. That way you can do comparisons much faster.
Yeah,
small things like that.
If the first 12 characters don't match, then you're done.
Yeah.
You don't have to compare with the rest, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Sense. But so that's for partitioning and metadata. I've been leaving ANN indexes like HNSW or DiskAnn or all that other stuff. I've been leaving those last because I really want those to also support metadata filtering and also support partitioning. And I think it's really hard to create an index and then add those features afterwards. Whereas if I create the index with those built in, it'd be a little bit easier. That's one of the major reasons why I'm doing it. And also choosing the right ANN index is very difficult, especially under the constraints that SQLite Vec has. For example, most ANN indexes out there, they store everything in memory, right? They are serialized to disk in some way, but like they store it in memory and they don't have to worry about like lookups and all that in certain ways because it's usually in memory and does all that stuff, right? With SQLite Vec, it's going to store those usually inside of shadow tables with SQLite. So figuring out how like graphs or links are resolved or how fast that happens when they're stored on disk or on within a SQLite database file and how fast that can happen and how worrying about like page sizes and chunk sizing and all that.
That's something that
like is unique to SQLite Vec that I really want to make sure I get right. Because if I do something wrong, it's going to be like either waste a lot of memory or not that great or very hard to reason about and maybe potentially unsafe because again, this is in C. So that's one of the reasons why I've been holding off on it just because I really want to make sure I get it right. And there's so many ANN indexes to choose from that I want to like explore them, try to figure out which one's right and all that with partitioning and which metadata filters included. So that's one of the main reasons why I've held on it. I would say that like for a lot of use cases that people use SQLite Vec for, if you only have 100,000 vectors, SQLite Vec will work just fine. A brute force search will probably work just fine. And you could also use Matryoshka embeddings or binary quantization or scalar quantization to make that a little bit smaller. And you can approximate what ANN index does using those quantization methods to a certain point. So that's usually what I've been like told users, oh, try out binary quantization, see if that works. If you're going to try like 20 million embeddings, SQLite Vec currently can't do it. Hopefully when I figure out what the right and what the best ANN index is, then I'll include it and then all your genes will be solved.
So I remember playing around with SQLite Vec on our live stream and the binary trick just works. It really saves off a lot of compute and a lot of disk space. And also if you have 100,000 things, especially if you don't have embeddings that are like thousands and thousands wide, it's a simple thing. It works, comes with Python, pretty easy. It's just the nice feeling of it. I guess the closest thing, LanceDB does come to mind as like a thing that kind of feels like SQLite. It's also based on disk. But also there you notice that they do a k-means thing as an index as opposed to HNSW. Because again, it's the disk thing. And so many extra concerns pop up if you want to do disk stuff instead of keeping it all in memory. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I would say USearch does something as well. They have, or does similar local first vector search stuff. It's a C++ library that has bindings with a lot of different languages. They also have a brute force index and also an HNSW index, but I believe it stores HNSW stuff in memory quite a lot. DuckDB also does vector search and it actually uses USearch for their HNSW implementation, but it stores that into memory, right? And I believe currently it doesn't persist to disk. I might be wrong about that. They might have updated recently, but at least at first, it wouldn't persist it to memory, so you have to recreate it from scratch every time, which can be a little bit hard.
I think the Supabase people also have something like that for Postgres, and I believe their HNSW thing is also extra memory like needs. I could be mistaken on that, but it does feel like that's That's a path you can do. There's nothing wrong with it. It does tend to work for a lot of people, but not everyone has a big beefy memory machine. Memory is still not cheap yet, not compared to disk.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So I guess like a couple of final just questions out of interest. I really like to see stuff like this happen. And I'm also happy to hear that the humble Chromebook beginnings have helped inspire this one. Something about that is like a nice little full circle. Have you gotten any like interesting applications from it at this point, though? Because it feels like it's been out for a while, long enough that people could have actually been started using it. Have you had any stories from the field or like things you're looking forward to? This might become possible soon.
Yeah, I think, I don't know how many things have reached production yet, but I've heard a lot of people testing things out of an iOS app that does semantic search over photos, like your photo roll or whatever, and you can do grouping and clustering through there. Or medical devices, or not medical devices, but in a medical setting where they have an application that runs in hospital servers and they need something that's no dependencies, works in a single binary, and they want to do some form of vector search. So they could do something like, they could work with something like that, or they could work with SQLite Vec because it doesn't require a separate server or anything complicated. Mm-hmm. I've talked with possibilities of it being in large desktop applications that potentially might be a web browser, things like that, where people, I think most of the time it's like, either one, we're working with images and we want image embeddings and we need something like lightweight because we're on mobile devices or such, or two, we already have a full text search engine and we want to have hybrid search just to have a more fuzzy thing. And typically, a lot of times they're already using SQLite because SQLite FTS5 already exists and is already pretty great. So adding semantic search to that would be nice. That's another very common use case that I see. And also just like developer tools, right? Like you don't want to, if you have a VS Code extension, you don't want to install like Postgres to store embeddings. So you could use, you're already running on a developer's computer, you could use SQLite to store vectors in there or do something there. So I think there's a lot of interest there as well. That makes a lot of sense given like SQLite Vec benefits and also, yeah.
Okay, cool. Now, so like I remember in the live stream, I was just contemplating, oh man, it could actually be cool if I'm building like just a normal tabular classifier. Like that could maybe go into SQLite at some point. And then SQLite can become the machine learning algorithm because, hey, I've got a new thing. What are the 100 things that look most like it? Oh, vector lookup, basically. And then you've got your classifier. And it does feel like the world still needs to get used to it, that you can do some of that stuff in SQLite, which is why I'm asking. But it is really cool to hear about the hospital applications, though. That makes a ton of sense. Because you want stuff to be lightweight and local. And also hospitals typically don't have the beefiest machines. So that actually does feel like a really nice fit. Yeah. Cool. Is there anything you would like to maybe tell people? Like people are looking for open source projects and maybe they're interested in this space. Like where might they be able to find you? What are things that they might want to be looking at? Any shout outs?
Yeah. If you go to alexgarcia.xyz, that's my website. I have my Twitter and GitHub link there, as well as all the other projects. So SQLite Vec and everything, that's linked there. If you want to like go check me out, follow me on Twitter, whatever, or LinkedIn. I've weirdly noticed a lot more developer content on LinkedIn that's actually pretty good and not too LinkedIn. I find that pretty interesting. But yeah, check out SQLite Vec. Check out Dataset as well. Dataset.io if you want to check out the open source project and some of the things that it could do. We are currently working on what Dataset 1.0 is going to be like. It's currently been in this 0.65 stage for quite some time, so we're trying to figure out a stable long-term thing for that. So if you want to check out the open source project for Dataset.io, there's also Dataset.cloud if you're interested in the SaaS version of it. And you could set up a call with Simon or I there if you want to chat more about how you could use Dataset Cloud if you're interested in that. And yeah, definitely check out SQLite Vec. That's SQLite-VEC. GitHub page for it. There's a few issues on there if you want to give it a thumbs up if you're interested in it. So the ANN index or metadata filters or whatever else is there. I'm more than happy to chat there. There's also a link in that README to the SQLite Vec Discord channel in the Mozilla AI Discord. I recommend that Discord in general. There's a lot of really good conversations and talk there. I give a lot of updates for SQLite Vec and a lot of other, you know, SQLite Vec related news in that Discord as well. So make sure to check that out. That'd be great.
Yeah. And as a final plug, the Dataset Discord is well above average too.
Yes.
Like I'm enjoying my time there as well. I'm a happy member of that. So cool. Now, this has been an inspiring story. Thanks, Alex. And keep up the good work. See you on the internet. And I'm very curious where this SQLite Vec will go. It does feel like it can go to a bunch of places. So I'm looking forward to it.
For sure. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Happy to do it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Sample Space, and thanks in particular for making it all the way till the end. I really hope you're enjoying these podcasts that we're making here over at Probable. If you're interested to see more, you can find the podcasts on your favorite podcast player, but you can also go to our YouTube channel. And if you're interested, you can also reach out to us on socials. You can find us on LinkedIn, but we also are getting more active on Blue Sky these days. And in particular, if you want to speak to me personally about maybe some guests I got to interview, you can also find me as well as many of my colleagues on our Discord. go to discord.probable.ai. You'll find us there, and feel free to give us any feedback you might have. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and see you again next time.